Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode examines the civil war in South Sudan and the possible refugee crisis to follow. In this hour, we'll hear from Valentino Achekdang. He's co-founder of the Valentino Achekdang Foundation. Joining him is Gabrielle Akim, spokesperson for Rebuild South Sudan, and Diana Essex-Lettieri, deputy director at Asylum Access. This event was recorded before a World Affairs audience, and the broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron.
Good evening. I don't blame you for showing up tonight. This is going to be a wonderful program. I'm going to say a little bit more about our speakers than engage in a conversation. But Valentino Achekdang is co-founder and executive director of the foundation by his name. He's a leader of the South Sudan diaspora here and has done a great deal to advance the notion of a universal right to education. He was Minister of Education from Northern Bahr el Ghazal. Did I say that correctly? And you all probably know that the novel by Dave Edgar, What Is What, was based on Valentino's life. So if you have still outstanding questions about his life, you can buy the book. So Diana Essex-Lettieri is Deputy Director of Asylum Access, which is here in Oakland. We're thrilled that they are here. And she oversees the international operations, among other things, but that seems good enough to me. She was a visiting scholar at Stanford Center for International Security and Cooperation, and previously worked at Oxfam America. I'm sorry I have my back to so many of you. I'll try to wiggle around so we can see each other. Gabrielle Akim is an advisor to Rebuild South Sudan, which is a nonprofit organization. He was born in Sudan. He was brought up in the Natingo refugee camp and then immigrated to the United States through our refugee program and lives in the Bay Area right now. Now, the interesting thing is Valentino and Gabrielle just met each other tonight as we walked in, so they'll have catching up to do. So please join me in welcoming them. So, Diana, I'm going to start with you. South Sudan is a young country, the result of a war that broke off from Sudan. Say a word about the status of South Sudan right now. Obviously, there is ongoing conflict, so say a word about that.
Well, thank you. Let me start by saying thank you for having me, and thank you for calling attention to this really important topic. And I'm really looking forward to hearing from both Valentino and Gabriel tonight. As a starting point, I wonder if I could say something about what is the status of the refugee situation in the world today?
Okay.
And in the world today, there are 21 million refugees. And less than 1% of those refugees annually are going to access the kind of program that will bring them to the United States or to Australia or to New Zealand. And that means that for the most part, refugees will remain in countries that neighbor their own. And what makes that reality particularly challenging is a couple of things. First is the reality is that for the most part, refugees do not have access to important basic human rights, like the right to work, like the right to move freely, like access to justice. And the second thing that makes this particularly challenging is the amount of time that people spend in situations of exile. On average, refugees are spending 20 years living in exile, and that number is growing. So when we think about what's happening in South Sudan, I think about what's happening to the refugees who are crossing borders. Mm-hmm. And the numbers are quite large, and they're winding up in situations where we have to ask, what is the refugee policy, and is it supporting them in being able to rebuild their lives?
Now, is it about 1.6 million from South Sudan? Am I right about that?
That's
what
right.
are the figures?
Okay. That's 1.6 million.
And then there's displaced within.
Which is even a greater number than that.
Yeah.
And I wanted to call attention to Uganda, which in the past couple of years has received about 800,000 refugees, on top of about 400,000 that were already there. Mm-hmm. And Uganda is upheld internationally as a country with a really progressive refugee policy. The government intends, from the moment a refugee crosses the border, to give refugees 5 years before they're self-sustained. And they give you a plot of land. And the laws and policies that go along with that reinforce that a refugee should be able to rebuild their life. So they're giving refugees the right to work and the right to move freely. And this is almost unheard of, actually, for a lot of refugee situations around the world.
And are they able to send their kids to school?
Yes. They're able to send their kids to school. We should ask one of these two about what that reality is, who both of whom have a greater background in education.
So there's Uganda, there's Ethiopia. What is their capacity to absorb?
It's such a great question. The progressive refugee policy that I just referenced in Uganda is certainly being challenged by the sheer numbers of people. And this is where the international community really has an important role to play. This progressive refugee policy can do a lot to help people rebuild their lives. And in fact, if you look at the case of Uganda, you have more people in jobs in comparison to most other refugee situations around the world. And they're hiring Ugandans. Mm-hmm. And what we're hearing from Uganda is, this is so good for our country too. This is improving our economy. But when you have such a profound refugee crisis like what we're seeing out of Uganda, which is now the third greatest refugee crisis in the world and the single largest refugee crisis in Africa, then you're going to start to see cracks in that policy.
Right.
And some of those cracks are that you're seeing some isolated instances of violence and also maybe things like local governments along the border pushing back against receiving large numbers of refugees. But to Uganda's credit, they have not changed their policy. And the international community should recognize that and ask how they can support.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they can support in a few different ways. Uganda has made public its budget. They've made public its budget for how much money it takes in order to continue to give people access to the kinds of freedoms that they need to rebuild their lives. And to date, that budget is 15% funded. So you can see that even if a country is trying to do its best, and in the case of Uganda, this is a rather altruistic policy, it still needs the kind of support from the international community to continue to keep doors open and to continue to provide people with the really important rights of access to work and right to move freely and right to make these basic and important choices about their lives.
So, Gabrielle, I'm going to turn to you and we'll talk a little bit about your own life story. But first, and this is in context of your own experience, in situations of civil war, both back when it was all Sudan and even now within the warring parties within South Sudan, what happens to the boys? Do they kind of face, if they're not in school? And it's pretty hard to be in school during conflict. Do they face kind of a choice between joining a militia or being the victims of one? What is that young boy faced with?
Exactly what is happening in South Sudan, it is something that just started recently. But the life of the boys or the girls who are the refugees is kind of different. My life and the life of South Sudan's Sudanese people, it's kind of like different. Because where I grew up as a refugee in Kakuma, in Kenya. So when I came to United States in 2006, July, then I considered South Sudan to be my country. But when I feel like refugees. So when I came over here, I talk about the refugees, the people who are in the camp. So I've been back to South Sudan many, many times. You know, the life of the refugees, when they go, number one is to find the safe place where they can stay. Number two is to find food to eat. If they cannot find those things, that's whereby some people choose to go to war. Mm-hmm. But if they find something that they can survive, there's nobody like war. Nobody went to die. So I've been back to Kenya and Uganda, and I saw Yeah, there's a lot of boys in the refugee camps. And I've been talking to some people. And when I came to the United States, I told them, like, you know, I'm not going to go to America and then do what like what other people do. Some people, they came and they don't want to go back. I went to Uganda in 2011 with one of the organizations that used to work with the refugees. Maybe for some of you, who know me before, I work with an organization called Assist International. So it's one of the organizations that work around the world. And then also, I'm advisor to rebuild South Sudan. And my language, always when I talk about the refugees, because that's my people. Whether you are from other country, I know the life of refugees. It's not a good life. It's kind of the life that you've been forced by other people, harassment life. So some people who are in the refugee schemes, I've been talking to some people and the organization that I work. There's some good people who turn out to help those children. Like last year I was in Uganda, in one of the refugees called Ajumuni. And then there's another refugee called Bayala near Kampala. And because I have no power, I have no fund to send them to school, I have seen them. Some of them, they're not going to school because what UN provide is a food. That's number one, and the shelter. The last one is education, but there's like no education because there are like so many refugees over there. Even though they're trying to build a school, the number of the refugees is growing. Even where I came from, Kakuma refugees came. It was started in 1992. But you can find some people, they're still there. They have nowhere to go. Resettlement is a big problem. Like when I came to the United States, I was supposed to come with my brother. But by luck, when we went for interview, I was the one who would do interview for him because he was underage and he don't speak English. At the end, the thing turned that he has not passed the interview. Even though he didn't say anything, he was just there, he don't speak English. We have the same mom, the same father, the same life background. I explained everything. It didn't work out.
So where is he now?
Now he's back to South Sudan. So the life of the refugees, like some people, they go to war because they have nothing to do. But if they get education, they can get their education outside Kenya or Uganda.
Yeah.
And actually, I've been helping like about 60 children now in Uganda in one of the refugees.
So you've been raising funds so that they can go to school, right?
Yes. Right? I started with like 10 children.
Yeah.
And then some people from the churches, they're like, okay, I want to sponsor the child through this organization. Or is there an organization that you know? I'm like, yes, I know this organization. It went up to 60. And then I'm going back again in September. Or I may go in December because I have a school now. I go to San Jose State. So I may graduate next year.
So Valentino, let's talk a little bit about your own experience. I mean, as I mentioned, it's the basis for a book. But you made a choice. I think you were only 7, weren't you, when you were displaced? So talk about the beginning. Because you walked, I just remember you telling the tale of walking all the way across countries at a very young boy.
Yes. I want to thank all of you for coming here. San Francisco is a nice place, and people here are amazing. I always look forward to coming here and eating my best chicken wings, spicy buffalo wings. And yes, walking around Union Square is fantastic. I think I should talk as a refugee. I went to a camp when I was very young, and I was about 10 years old.
Ten.
7 is too young. I went back and to trace how much I would have been to be able to walk across a very unforgiving regions of South Sudan in 1980s. And I went to the camp as a very young boy and as unaccompanied minors. I was fortunate enough because I walked across Sudan at a time when the revolutionary spirit was so strong across the country, and people were helping each others, and the same spirit of comradeships, nationalism was in the camp. So those of us who found ourselves young in the camp were taken care of by our own people and also by the humanitarian agencies. And also our host country of Ethiopia understood very well the situation in South Sudan. So I went to a camp where there were more than 20,000 unaccompanied minors, many young people, people I have not met before, speaking languages I did not know. So I was young without a family, but I think I was accommodated very well at the camps. There was a psychosocial program being run by the Swedish writer Barnen. It's called Save the Children Today. There was USAID. I could see a bag of maize with a writing gift from the American people back then. I did not know what it was back in the days, but I came to know later. The camp was a new camp, a lot of makeshift houses, a lot of displaced families, people trying to figure out how to reunite with their families and how to go back. So I think when I speak about my childhood, I should just say what it was to go to the camp as unaccompanied minors and being welcomed and given special care, psychosocial care, and then I went to school in the camp.
You know, you referred to the psychosocial care, and when I think about what you and Gabriel went through, we refer to that here as toxic stress. It was an extraordinary experience of being separated from your family, dealing with hunger, dealing with disease, dealing with fear. Is there a way to overcome that for the rest of your life? Are you able to process that kind of experience?
I overcame those experiences long before I came to America. Mm-hmm. One aspect of that is that I was a very young African child brought up in the African village. And as young, I had to go to the cattle camps, take care of cows. You walk, you follow your domestic animal day throughout most of the times. I necessarily didn't have to stay with my family most of the time. When I walk across South Sudan, working was not a problem. The challenges were that of insecurity and not being able to go back to your family. But again, being young and I think the age factor played a significant role at that time, in the sense that as a young person, sometimes there are times you cry because you are hungry or because you are in pain or because you are exhausted. But then there are times you play and you are happy and you play with another boy or other girls. There are times you are in a school. And I told you before that the South Sudanese society back then and still now is a communal setting. So an adult person would not let another child be taken advantage of or misused or waste his precious future by engaging in unwanted lifestyle or misbehave. So we were together and the community was there. If you go to any South Sudanese refugee camp, you will find a community leadership. You'll find a youth leadership. And sometimes people are categorized into areas they come from so that somebody who knows them remind these kids, I know your father, I know your family, you come from these people, you can't give up. And what I'm telling you, this, the so-called lost boys are some of the most sensitive young unaccompanied minors the world had in the 1980s. When we came to America, sometimes people do not understand how we cope with certain conditions here. And among this group now are PhD holders from Harvard, from Ivy League school. So if they had not overcome those challenges way before they come, they wouldn't have managed to cope with themselves. So it's one thing to be displaced from your family. It's another to be with people who care for you. And it's another also to overcome those challenges. I overcame those hard experiences long before I came to America. And that's the reason I came here, got opportunities picked up, and I knew I am a responsible person. I cannot come here, sit and keep quiet and pretend nothing is happening. And I am now helping thousands of young people as a result of my struggle. So I overcame those things long ago, not now.
And now you say, first of all, you're trying very hard to ensure that that young people in South Sudan get an education. But you've also said publicly that you think they can be the future of South Sudan, to build it not only as a country but as a democracy. Talk a little bit about what they're experiencing and how your work, how access to education is going to help them be that future.
So young people are the future of any country. And South Sudan is not exceptional. The young people I work with have demonstrated in a number of ways that they are indeed in future. We went back, we started a school with kids who would never have managed to go to high school whatsoever. Some of those kids are graduating now as engineers, as medical doctors, as nurses. And they're doing fantastic jobs. So it's a proof that from 2007 when we got them, they have now proven that they are future and they are working. The South Sudanese young people who came to America by 2001 have gone to school, have worked here, are married. Like him, he's staying, he's raising kids.
Gabriel has a 2-year-old and a 1-year-old. So
they are in the government back in South Sudan. In fact, the national dialogue is being headed by members of the Lost Boys who came here and went to school, and they're going back and they're helping their people. So they are leaders in their own way. So for me, young people in every given situation are the future. They are a guarantee for the future, and investing in them is investing in a society.
So, Diana, the basis for our democracy is pluralism, right? The ability of different cultures to live side by side in a larger shared society. To what extent is the educational experience in a place like South Sudan, the place where you do rub shoulders with other ethnic groups, speaking other local languages? In other words, is school a platform for establishing a relationship with the other and preparing for a life of a pluralistic society?
I think we should punt this question to one of these two who understands South Sudan very well. But I could speak to your question in terms of refugee situations, those from South Sudan. And I think that it's really important for us to recognize that the kind of opportunities that those who access the resettlement program, who can get to the United States or to the UK or to Canada and get access to higher education and go on to lead very fulfilling lives, is not the norm. And that education within refugee situations in the global South does offer this opportunity for children to get to know those of their host communities and is an opportunity to start to overcome discrimination and xenophobia. Yep. And that can be one of the de facto barriers from people being able to rebuild their lives. Mm-hmm. And so in thinking about what the predominant response to refugee situations is today, is humanitarian aid, or the provision of food, water, and medical care. And while food, water, and medical care is incredibly important in the immediate aftermath of an emergency, after the 5th or the 10th or the 15th year of living in exile, you can imagine that it stops being a lifeline.
Right.
And starts being something standing in the way of what feels like progress for you. I once spoke to a Bhutanese refugee who had lived in a Nepali refugee camp for the first 18 years of her life before she was resettled to the United States. And she said that after so many years, she watched people's minds frost over. This was her language, people's minds frost over. And what I think she meant is that when you can't find a sense of purpose and you can't find a sense of productivity and you aren't able to take care of yourself and your family, some of those elements that make you feel human start to go away. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And access to education is one really important piece of being able to overcome that and get to know your host communities and your host communities get to know you. You can start to overcome some of the things standing in the way of a host country being able to build a legal framework that allows people the kinds of opportunities that the resettlement program can bring people.
So let me just go back to that question for you, Valentino, because I think you very purposely seek students from all around so that they do get to know each other from other ethnic groups. Am I right about that?
Yes. I think diversity is very important in our work. At times you realize that some people have opportunities, educational opportunities, even in the refugee camp set up, and others do not have those opportunities. I spent time in Kakuma refugee camp working with young people, and Kakuma refugee camp had refugees from 8 different countries, different ethnicities, and even I visited the camp 2 months ago, and there are 21 different ethnicities in Kakuma, from different part of Africa and Germany, and it is interesting when you see even Christian refugee student going to the same school with the Muslim refugee student. So for us, it's important to make our institution as diverse as possible. And in South Sudan, we have done that by going to areas where different ethnicities are and bring kids to the ethnicity where we are going to school. Mm-hmm. And that kind of a mixture had worked out very well, in the kind that you see kids get to know each other, they live together, they play sport together, they take care of each other's. Although sometimes that thing is overclouded by some policies that we're not in control of, or by economic crisis that hinder our ability to reach out to areas we want to go to. Yeah. So we do that, but I learned that when I was in the camp. I was a South Sudanese, and then I met with different South Sudanese, and I became a head of an institution in the camp where I had to work with the Somalis, with the Eritrean, with the Ethiopian, with Kenyan, with people from Rwanda and elsewhere where refugees come from. So diversity is important in our work in South Sudan as well as in the refugee camps where I had lived.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Valentino Achekdang. He's co-founder of the Valentino Achekdang Foundation. We're also hearing from Gabriel Akim, spokesperson for Rebuild South Sudan, and Diana Essex-Lettieri, deputy director at Asylum Access. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience.
And Gabrielle, as you think about the future, here you've been raising funds so kids can go to school. Is that what you'll continue to do, or how do you?
Actually, that's what I'm working at, because as I said, the life of refugees is the life that I had before, and I have like an experience of that. So for me, what I saw in South Sudan, yes, the problem sometimes when you look at people, majority of people are not educated. If you look at the population and the kind of education that they have, it's a big issue. And you know, like, the more educated, if you become educated, then the more the problem goes down. For example, you cannot find like some people who are PhD holders fighting on the street.
Yeah.
No. When I go back to the refugee scheme and I know the situation that I faced before, because I was a refugee, I know it's very terrible. And even in Kakuma, some that I left before in 2006, they're still over there. And why? The reason they don't want to go back to South Sudan, because South Sudan is not safe right now in some places, and especially in our home area or our region, the Upper Nile regions, where I came from. That's a big issue. And the only way that can change South Sudan is education. For example, the state that I came from Jonglei State, where there are like tribal wars between Murle and Dinka Bor, where some people, especially like Murle people, they just take like, they kidnap the children from other tribe and they adopt them as their own children. It didn't make no sense. And because they have no education background, they have no schools, even though they have been told to go to school, they cannot. So to me, I just decided to work with anybody who is in the refugee camps, because I'm not a part of the government. I like some people, even when I went to school, I was going to do engineering, and I say, like, if I get my degree in engineering, where am I going to practice it? I changed my mind. I say, okay, let me go to justice and human right. So I took justice as a major, and then I'm taking human right as a minor. Yes.
This is right now.
Right now.
Yeah.
And then I'm hoping to graduate next year, and I start doing practice on my field. Last year I was in the refugee scheme, working with the refugees. And that's where my dream is, that one day, one time, if the refugees, if they can get their education outside, they will go back like us. Some of the lost boys who came to the United States, they got their education, and then they start bringing change to South Sudan. The change begins slowly. Not the people who are inside who can bring change, no. You can get example from others. Like the example that we get from United States. When we came to United States, we found like a different people living together peacefully. So if people from my country, let's say they come and then they learn and they go back and they train the refugees, because someone who grew up in the refugees camps, he or she know the consequence of the war. When she go back and then she become a leader, she know. So that's why I'm still working now with the refugees camp, and that's my dreams.
So then I'm going to take us back to policy just for a moment, because here we have, well, I'll start with policies of host countries, but then I'm going to ask you about U.S. policy. In a lot of refugee situations, the reason they can't go to school is that the school system simply can't absorb them. Or the reason they can't get a job is the sense that they would be taking jobs away from the workers of that host country. I'm struck by the fact, for example, that Germany has a real labor shortage, yet it feels overwhelmed by in particular the Syrian refugee crisis, but beyond. How do you work with host countries and gaining a sense of what they can provide by way of work or cannot? What is realistic?
This is such a great question. And I'm going to take us back to Uganda as an example, because the question you're asking is understudied. And we don't have great data. globally to look at. But Uganda is a place where there has been an incredible amount of research done. And what we have seen is that when you allow refugees to enter the economy expands, and it is better for all involved. Not allowing refugees to enter the economy is a great way to depress wages. You have keep an incredible number of people in the informal economy, and when you keep people in the informal economy, it lowers wages not just for refugees, but also for the local populations. There's a great study out of Jordan that showed that refugees were willing to play a variety of necessary and missing roles within the economy, but they don't have the kind of permissions to do so. So I think it's important that we ask, that we challenge the assumptions of that narrative. And in your question of how do we help host governments to be able to provide these kinds of freedoms for people, sharing the evidence is a great starting point. And having advocates armed with that evidence is a great starting point. And then beyond that, I really do think it is about a combination of funding. There is a shortage right now of funding available for refugee situations generally. Yeah. And where it's there, it's continuing primarily to go to humanitarian aid. Also, diplomatic engagements. There's been some great examples recently. Under the Obama administration, there was an effort that's called the Obama Summits to bring together countries around the world to see a new kind of commitment made on behalf of governments around the world. And it has resulted in some very concrete changes in policy. We're seeing Thailand for the first time saying they're considering a screening mechanism that will acknowledge that refugees are indeed in need of international protection, which is a real departure. Asylum Access has clients that have spent years at detention facilities, women and children in detention facilities, waiting for an opportunity to be resettled because the legal framework in Thailand doesn't acknowledge that refugees exist. And then a third is technical assistance and guidance and administrative support. It's not easy to welcome a million people to your country in a very short period of time. And to villainize host countries doesn't help anybody in the story either. I think in most instances, there are genuine concerns mixed in with myths and assumptions.
I know that UNHCR has been collaborating with various technology companies and nonprofits to try to solve that problem of identity. Back to policy. Sorry for I keep doing this, Diana. But knowing what we know about the extent of the migrant crisis broadly and the refugee crisis somewhat more narrowly, is it morally acceptable that we're declining, that the U.S. is putting a hold on accepting refugees?
No. It's for many years, the United States has been a leader in refugee response around the world, and we're currently backsliding in that leadership. And we're seeing that backsliding in many ways, not just the rhetoric out of the current administration, but in concrete action. The White House budget, the proposed White House budget, which will be up for a vote in September, has budget cuts not just for refugees arriving to the United States, but also budget cuts that help refugees overseas and the emergency fund. The emergency fund would go to help situations like what's happening out of South Sudan. And then, of course, we've seen in one of the most recent executive orders a cut in the number of refugees we're willing to accept through the resettlement program that has brought the United States so much good over the last years. And that cap is being reduced from 110,000 to 50,000 people. I think when you compare, in Uganda, again, as an example, they're host to 1.2 million people in a country with 43 million. In Lebanon, 1 in 6 people is a refugee. And in the United States, we're taking in 50,000 a year with a population of 323 million. So if we want to talk about whether or not we are doing our fair share, are we sharing responsibility, it's quite clear that we are not.
And of course, Valentino, what you want to do is create circumstances under which people don't have to be refugees, right? And so I wanted to, because the other big budget cut is in economic development assistance. And, you know, both the political work that's done through the UN, but also the humanitarian assistance. Talk a little bit about the South Sudan you see today, the number of warring factions, your sense about whether political settlements are at hand or whether economic development aid can be delivered safely.
South Sudan is a country with many challenges. Many of these challenges are internal, but there are also challenges that are external. It's also a new country that got independent about 6 years ago and still going through a number of transformations. The aid, humanitarian aid, is needed in South Sudan. And when you provide a humanitarian aid, it's not supposed to be conditional, because you are reaching to vulnerable people in a remote place that, if you are selective in how you want to help them, you may not be able to help or provide the needed help in timely fashion. So what I've seen from inside South Sudan is that the government and all other warring parties are always welcoming of the humanitarian aid that goes to the local populations. In fact, the president declared a country, a famine-stricken state. A few months ago, yes, and it's needed. But again, there are reports coming out that that things are improving, not as they seem to be a few months ago. Yes, there are challenges that the humanitarian aids and people providing aids face, particularly in areas that are that have fresh conflicts going on. Yeah. And you're not going to say it's the government or the rebel or the UN agencies making it difficult to reach there. It's just the war and security circumstances. Yeah. Yeah. And also what I have observed throughout the latest state of conflict in South Sudan is that there have been a robust humanitarian response. In fact, at time, if you arrive at Juba Airport, you would see it like as if it is a big economical hubs. You see aircraft I've never seen in South Sudan delivering food. You see kind of medical support, medicine, San Frontiers, whatever, all CCM flying plane to risky areas and flying doctors. And there's a lot of response. So, and there are also challenges that the government faces with humanitarian support and challenges that humanitarian agency faces because of the government restrictions here and there, and challenges that the aid agencies face because if they go to areas where there are clashes, then either the rebel or the government army will have problem with them. So there are all those kind of challenges. But I see a South Sudan that is improving. I see a South Sudan that has a lot of challenges. I see a South Sudan that needed positive support from the international community and from regional countries. I see a country that have the opportunity to recoup and picked up and stabilizes. So I'm very hopeful about South Sudan's future. That seemed like a mistake to a lot of people I meet, and has been my hope even when I came to America many years ago. It's just a country with challenges. The leadership needed a lot of understanding. the people need a lot of understanding for them to be able to do right.
Now, back then, what we used to worry about was Bashir, the president of Sudan. I think because humanitarian assistance goes through the government, I think humanitarian agencies were worried about things going through President al-Bashir.
Yes.
Is there a similar reluctance now with South Sudan, or is mostly the issue just the physical question of the delivery of the food and medicines?
Well, we're still worried about al-Bashir today. He is still Omar al-Bashir. But when I looked at South Sudan, I see a situation where there is misunderstanding between South Sudanese authorities, the government, and the humanitarian aid agencies, and sometimes Western powers. You know, perception is a big disease. The way we perceive each other's can let us reject each other's without a reason, or accept each other's without knowing ourselves properly. I have been in South Sudan even throughout this conflict, and I have not seen local authorities rejecting aid support. I have not seen that. In fact, they need it. They always call out for international interventions in cases of hunger, in case of diseases, and even in cases of governance. You go to all the ministries and you find some body attached there from the UN or from a friendly country, trying to help build the capacity, trying to identify loophole and help them. In fact, if you go to the government, you'll find very well documents and policies planned, but to implement them is where there's a misunderstanding, and that's where there's challenge. So South Sudan need people, the leadership needs humanitarian aid. But there are misunderstandings somewhere that need to be ironed out.
And what role do you feel you're playing in ironing out misunderstandings? You're able to tell the story of South Sudan here. You're able to tell the story of what youth can be there, and you're able to tell the story, not only get things done, like providing an education, but also tell the story of the outside world's response.
The story I would tell, well, from the humanitarian perspective, South Sudanese are in need. If there are diseases, if there is hunger, if there is conflict, somebody who knows how to mitigate those risks is needed to come and help. If there are problems with governance, someone who can help in that area could come in and help. In fact, the South Sudanese society is very welcoming of international mediations in case of their issues. That story need to be told. Another story I can say is that the problem of South Sudan is a power struggle between those who want power and those who have it. And if you don't understand it, you will come in the middle and you will be implicated and you will go around talking. But you will never get the truth, because there are people fighting up there for power and they're going outside to blackmail each other, and you get in. But then my case is where the civilians are. We need stability.
Because they're the
real country
sufferers.
Is so young for it to be fighting about power. He should have been fighting about building the infrastructure, getting bilateral loan to build road, to build electricity, to build bridges, to do food security and all those. That is the story I want to tell. I don't want to talk about the story of who needs power and who should have it. I want to tell the story of a people who have suffered so much for many decades, who should be stable.
Almost all the question cards I've received have essentially the same question, and that is, what can we do? So that's the best way to sum up about 15 of these cards. And so I'm going to end with you. I'm going to start with you, Gabriel. As you look at what could we do, could either be what could our country do, or it could be what can we do as individuals? I know you've partly answered that question by raising money for scholarships. Yeah. But is there more you would want to say to the question?
Exactly, you know, like when you look at the history of South Sudan and what separates South Sudan to be like another country from North was the United States, was a help from U.S. Without U.S., South Sudan should not be a country. And during that time, when U.S. decide that South Sudan should be a different country, they didn't say it by word. They say and then they do it and they punt it. They donate a lot of money to South Sudan. At the beginning, South Sudan was a rich country in East Africa. Billions of dollars were donated by the United States, and then they were having oil. South Sudan was like Alaska to the United States. But the question, to me, it is hard to answer. The question is, where those money, where do they go? That's a question that goes to the leaders, to the leadership of South Sudan. And when you ask that question, you are in trouble. And to me, what I see in South Sudan, it is hard to tell people this is what needs to be done. Because I'm doing justice. And if I see something which is injustice, I tell people this is not the right things. In my own analysis, what I see in South Sudan, democracy does not exist. There's no life of democracy in South Sudan. Some people who are doing a good job in South Sudan, the change doesn't come from the government. It came from the NGOs, non-profit, other NGOs who are doing things in a different area. All the money that United States, the other donors, China, all those money that goes to South Sudan, where do they end? They end in capital city. When I went back to my home, my homelands in 2003, you know, in 2013, I had to walk. There's no road that the bike can go. But there were a lot of money that were donated. When you look at the budget, there are a lot of money that were donated for the construction, road construction, where those money goes.
One more question. Yes.
Hi, my name is Esther Spray, and I was actually introduced to Sudan by one of the Lost Boys of Sudan in 2003, and it completely changed my life, and I would say improved my life. So I think one of the main things people can do is get to know someone from another country. It'll certainly enrich your life. Mm. I wanted to ask Gabriel and Valentino. So the European Union has been providing funds to the Sudan government to curb immigration and refugees into Europe. And this is a government that actually creates refugees. So the European Union has paid over $10 million to the Sudan government.
Now you're talking about Bashir here.
Yes, yeah, Bashir. And then we're seeing within the United States that Obama lifted sanctions on the Sudan government in part because there was an assessment that Bashir was no longer engaged in fueling conflict in South Sudan, which we know isn't true. And so now the Trump administration is looking at whether or not to keep the sanctions off. So I just want to ask you both what you think as far as, do you see Bashir contributing to the crisis in South Sudan that is creating an even greater refugee crisis, like you talked about in Uganda and elsewhere?
So what I'm going to do is have you answer it, just because you started to answer it an earlier part of this evening's program.
Yeah, you know, Sudan, South Sudan succeeded from Bashir, and there are issues when somebody break away from a family. They also still have a link in the oil business, and I think Sudan played a role where it doesn't want South Sudan to prosper economically or security-wise. Because sometimes you see government of Sudan supporting just about anybody who want to take up arms against the government of South Sudan. The government of Sudan also accused South Sudan for doing similar work against Sudan. So there is a cold war there. There are South Sudanese refugees in Sudan who also needed support. I would not say don't give the government of Sudan the support needed to support those refugees. Because what I want to be helped are the people, not the government. But I would say be careful how that money is used. That's where the problem is. Whoever donated money should follow through and see that government being used to support the refugees or displaced people within Sudan. The same should be done anywhere where the fund is given to a government that had a history of human rights violation. Bashir has been accused for a very long time and he has continued to be in power. For me, I would say engage him instead of making things difficult for him, and then he goes down and make millions of people suffer. Maybe engage him and finish this thing with him, and then let the people be free. It's the same thing I was saying for the government of South Sudan too. They need to be engaged, and you help them solve the conflict. Because sometimes there's something about isolating some of the leaders when they control majority of the constituencies in their country. It continues conflict, it continues suffering, it doesn't solve the real issue. And again, maybe your question is more to do with it, and I'm not going to be able to address it because my target is always the people. When they are not free, I need that problem solved.
Thank you. I'm going to first ask you to just join me in thanking Valentino Achak-Chang, Diana Essex-Ichiari, and Gabriel it's Akim. Is I saying that correctly, Gabriel?
Akim. Akim. Yeah, I mean doctor.
It does. It means doctor. So please join me in thanking them.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can join us or visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Valentino Achak-Dang, co-founder of the Valentino Achak-Dang Foundation, Gabriel Akim, spokesperson for Rebuild South Sudan, and Diana Essex-Lecheri, who's deputy director of Asylum Access. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.